for an instant, hesitating as if shocked by the explosion. 15 billion droplets, 15 billion tears, 15 billion ornaments, jewels standing out against a white velvet viewing board. And then, with the light gone, the drops which had waited to have their pictures taken, which had suspended their downward rush, fell upon them, stinging, in an insect cloud of coldness and pain. "Stop it! Stop it!" "Pickard!" But Pickard was only standing now, alone. When the lieutenant switched on a small hand lamp and played it over Pickard's wet face, the eyes of the man were dilated, and his mouth was open, his face turned up, so the water hit and splashed on his tongue, and hit and drowned the wide eyes, and bubbled in a whispering froth on the nostrils. "Pickard!" The man would not reply. He simply stood there for a long while with the bubbles of rain breaking out in his whitened hair and manacles of rain jewels dripping from his wrists and his neck. "Pickard, we're leaving. We're going on. Follow us." The rain dripped from Pickard's ears. "Do you hear me, Pickard?" It was like shouting down a well. "Pickard!"
"Leave him alone," said Simmons.
"We can't go on without him."
"What'll we do, carry him?"
Simmons spat.
"He's no good to us or himself. You know what he'll do? He'll just stand here and drown."
"What?"
"You ought to know that by now. Don't you know the story? He'll just stand here with his head up and let the rain come in his nostrils and his mouth. He'll breathe the water."
"No."
"That's how they found General Ment that time. Sitting on a rock with his head back, breathing the rain. His lungs were full of water."
The lieutenant turned the light back to the unblinking face. Pickard's nostrils gave off a tiny whispering wet sound. "Pickard!" The lieutenant slapped the face.
"He can't even feel you," said Simmons. "A few days in this rain, and you don't have any face, or any legs, or hands?"
The lieutenant looked at his own hand in horror. He could no longer feel it. "But we can't leave Pickard here."
"I'll show you what we can do."
Simmons fired his gun. Pickard fell into the raining earth. Simmons said,
"Don't move, Lieutenant. I've got my gun ready for you, too. Think it over. He would only have stood or sat there and drowned. It's quicker this way."
The lieutenant blinked at the body. "But you killed him."
"Yes, because he'd have killed us by being a burden. You saw his face. Insane."
After a moment, the lieutenant nodded. "All right." They walked off into the rain. It was dark, and their hand lamps threw a beam that pierced the rain for only a few feet. After a half hour, they had to stop and sit through the rest of the night, aching with hunger, waiting for the dawn to come. When it did come, it was gray and continually raining as before, and they began to walk again.
"We've miscalculated," said Simmons.
"No, another hour."
"Speak louder. I can't hear you."
Simmons stopped and smiled.
"By Christ,"
he said and touched his ears.
"My ears. They've gone out on me. All the rain pouring finally numbed me right down to the bone."
"Can't you hear anything?" said the lieutenant.
"What?"
Simmons' eyes were puzzled. "Nothing, come on."
"I think I'll wait here." "You go on ahead."
"You can't do that."
"I can't hear you." "You go on. I'm tired. I don't think the sun dome is down this way. And if it is, it's probably got holes in the roof like the last one. I think I'll just sit here."
Get up from there!
So long, Lieutenant.
You can't give up now!
I've got a gun here that says I'm staying. I just don't give a damn anymore. I'm not crazy yet, but I'm the next thing to it. I don't want to go out that way. As soon as you get out of sight, I'm going to use this gun on myself.
Simmons!
You said my name. I can read that much off your lips.
Simmons!
Look, it's a matter of time. Either I die now, or in a few hours. Wait till you get to that next dome, if you ever get there, and find rain coming in through the roof. Won't that be nice?
The lieutenant waited, and then splashed off in the rain. He turned and called back once, but Simmons was only sitting there with the gun in his hands, waiting for him to get out of sight. He shook his head and waved the lieutenant on. The lieutenant didn't even hear the sound of the gun. He began to eat the flowers as he walked. They stayed down for a time, and weren't poisonous. Neither were they particularly sustaining, and he vomited them up, sickly, a minute or so later. Once he took some leaves and tried to make himself a hat, but he had tried that before. The rain melted the leaves from his head. Once picked, the vegetation rotted quickly and fell away into gray masses in his fingers. "Another 5 minutes," he told himself. "Another 5 minutes, and then I'll walk into the sea and keep walking. We weren't made for this. No Earthman was or ever will be able to take it. Your nerves! Your nerves!" He floundered his way through a sea of slush and foliage and came to a small hill. At a distance, there was a faint yellow smudge in the cold veils of water. The next sundome. Through the trees, a long round yellow building, far away. For a moment, he only stood swaying, looking at it. He began to run, and then he slowed down, for he was afraid. He didn't call out. What if it's the same one? What if it's the dead sundome, with no sun in it, he thought. He slipped and fell. Lie here, he thought. It's the wrong one. Lie here. It's no use. Drink all you want. But he managed to climb to his feet again and crossed several creeks. And the yellow light grew very bright, and he began to run again, his feet crashing into mirrors and glass, his arms flailing at diamonds and precious stones. He stood before the yellow door. The printed letters over it said, "The Sun Dome." He put his numb hand up to feel it. Then he twisted the doorknob and stumbled in. He stood for a moment looking about. Behind him the rain whirled at the door. Ahead of him, upon a low table, stood a silver pot of hot chocolate, steaming, and a cup full with a marshmallow in it. And beside that, on another tray, stood thick sandwiches of rich chicken meat and fresh-cut tomatoes and green onions. And on a rod just before his eyes was a great, thick, green Turkish towel, and a bin in which to throw wet clothes, and, to his right, a small cubicle in which heat rays might dry you instantly, and upon a chair a fresh change of uniform, waiting for anyone, himself or any lost one, to make use of it. And farther over, coffee in steaming copper urns, and a phonograph from which music was playing quietly, and books bound in red and brown leather. And near the books, a cot, a soft, deep cot, upon which one might lie, exposed and bare, to drink in the rays of the one great, bright thing which dominated the long room. He put his hands to his eyes. He saw other men moving toward him, but said nothing to them. He waited and opened his eyes and looked. The water from his uniform pooled at his feet, and he felt it drying from his hair and his face and his chest and his arms and his legs. He was looking at the sun. It hung in the center of the room, large and yellow and warm. It made not a sound, and there was no sound in the room. The door was shut, and the rain only a memory to his tingling body. The sun hung high in the blue sky of the room, warm, hot, yellow, and very fine. He walked forward, tearing off his clothes as he went. The Rocket Man. The electrical fireflies were hovering above Mother's dark hair to light her path. She stood in her bedroom door looking out at me as I passed in the silent hall. "You will help me keep him here this time, won't you?" she asked. "I guess so," I said. "Please?" The fireflies cast moving bits of light on her white face. "This time he mustn't go away again." "All right," I said, after standing there a moment. "But it won't do any good. It's no use." She went away, and the fireflies on their electric circuits fluttered after her like an errant constellation, showing her how to walk in darkness. I heard her say faintly, "We've got to try, anyway." Other fireflies followed me to my room. When the weight of my body cut a circuit in the bed, the fireflies winked out. It was midnight, and my mother and I waited, our rooms separated by darkness, in bed. The bed began to rock me and sing to me. I touched a switch. The singing and rocking stopped. I didn't want to sleep. I didn't want to sleep at all. This night was no different from a thousand others in our time. We would wake nights and feel the cool air turn hot, feel the fire in the wind, or see the walls burned a bright color for an instant, and then we knew his rocket was over our house. His rocket and the oak trees swaying from the concussion. And I would lie there, eyes wide, panting, and Mother in her room. Her voice would come to me over the interroom radio. "Did you feel it?" And I would answer, "That was him, all right." That was my father's ship passing over our town, a small town where space rockets never came, and we would lie awake for the next 2 hours thinking, "Now Dad's landed in Springfield. Now he's on the tarmac. Now he's signing the papers. Now he's in the helicopter. Now he's over the river. Now the hills. Now he's settling the helicopter in at the little airport at Green Village here." And the night would be half over when, in our separate cool beds, Mother and I would be listening, listening. "Now he's walking down Bell Street. He always walks. Never takes a cab. Now across the park, now turning the corner of Oakhurst, and now?" I lifted my head from my pillow, far down the street coming closer and closer, smartly, quickly, briskly, footsteps. Now turning in at our house, up the porch steps, and we were both smiling in the cool darkness, Mom and I. When we heard the front door open in recognition, speak a quiet word of welcome, and shut downstairs. 3 hours later, I turned the brass knob to their room quietly, holding my breath, balancing in a darkness as big as the space between the planets, my hand out to reach the small black case at the foot of my parents' sleeping bed. Taking it, I ran silently to my room, thinking, "He won't tell me. He doesn't want me to know." And from the opened case spilled his black uniform, like a black nebula, stars glittering here or there, distantly in the material. I needed the dark stuff in my warm hands. I smelled the planet Mars, an iron smell, and the planet Venus, a green ivy smell, and the planet Mercury, a scent of sulfur and fire. And I could smell the milky mood and the hardness of stars. I pushed the uniform into a centrifuge machine I'd built in my ninth grade shop that year, set it whirling. Soon, a fine powder precipitated into a retort. This I slid under a microscope, and while my parents slept unaware, and while our house was asleep, all the automatic bakers and servers and robot cleaners in an electric slumber, I stared down upon brilliant motes of meteor dust. Comet tail, and loam from far Jupiter glistening like worlds themselves, which drew me down to the tube a billion miles into space, at traffic accelerations. At dawn, exhausted with my journey and fearful of discovery, I returned the boxed uniform to their sleeping room. Then I slept, only to waken at the sound of the horn of the dry-cleaning car which stopped in the yard below. They took the black uniform box with them. It's good I didn't wait, I thought. For the uniform would be back in an hour, clean of all its destiny and travel. I slept again, with a little vial of magical dust in my pajama pocket, over my beating heart. When I came downstairs, there was Dad at the breakfast table, biting into his toast. "Sleep good, Doug?" he said, as if he had been there all the time, and hadn't been gone for 3 months. "All right," I said. "Toast?" He pressed a button, and the breakfast table made me 4 pieces, golden brown. I remember my father that afternoon digging and digging in the garden, like an animal after something, it seemed. There he was with his long dark arms moving swiftly, planting, tamping, fixing, cutting, pruning, his dark face always down to the soil, his eyes always down to what he was doing, never up to the sky, never looking at me, or mother even, unless we knelt with him to feel the earth soak up through the overalls at our knees, to put our hands into the black dirt and not look at the bright, crazy sky. Then he would glance to either side, to mother or me, and give us a gentle wink, and go on, bent down, face down, the sky staring at his back. That night we sat on the mechanical porch swing which swung us and blew a wind upon us and sang to us. It was summer and moonlight, and we had lemonade to drink, and we held the cold glasses in our hands, and Dad read the stereo newspapers inserted into the special hat you put on your head, and which turned the microscopic page in front of the magnifying lens if you blinked 3 times in succession. Dad smoked cigarettes and told me about how it was when he was a boy in the year 1997. After a while, he said, as he had always said, "Why aren't you out playing kick the can, Doug?" I didn't say anything, but Mom said, "He does, on nights when you're not here." Dad looked at me, and then, for the first time that day, at the sky. Mother always watched him when he glanced at the stars. The first day and night when he got home, he wouldn't look at the sky much. I thought about him gardening, and gardening so furiously, his face almost driven into the earth, but the second night he looked at the stars a little more. Mother wasn't afraid of the sky and the day so much, but it was the night stars that she wanted to turn off, and sometimes I could almost see her reaching for a switch in her mind, but never finding it. And by the third night, maybe Dad'd be out here on the porch until way after we were all ready for bed, and then I'd hear Mom call him in, almost like she called me from the street at times. And then I would hear Dad fitting the electric eye door lock in place with a sigh. And the next morning at breakfast, I'd glance down and see his little black case near his feet as he buttered his toast and mother slept late. "Well, be seeing you, Doug," he'd say, and we'd shake hands.
"In about 3 months?"
"Right." And he'd walk away down the street, not taking a helicopter or beetle or bus, just walking with his uniform hidden in his small underarm case. He didn't want anyone to think he was vain about being a rocket man. Mother would come out to eat breakfast, 1 piece of dry toast, about an hour later. But now it was tonight, the first night, the good night, and he wasn't looking at the stars much at all.
"Let's go to the television carnival,"
I said. Fine, said Dad. Mother smiled at me. And we rushed off to town in a helicopter and took Dad through 1,000 exhibits, to keep his face and head down with us and not looking anywhere else. And as we laughed at the funny things and looked serious at the serious ones, I thought, my father goes to Saturn and Neptune and Pluto, but he never brings me presents. Other boys whose fathers go into space bring back bits of ore from Callisto and hunks of black meteor or blue sand. But I have to get my own collection, trading from other boys. The Martian rocks and Mercurian sands which filled my room, but about which Dad would never comment. On occasion, I remembered, he brought something for Mother. He planted some Martian sunflowers once in our yard, but after he was gone a month and the sunflowers grew large, Mom ran out one day and cut them all down. Without thinking, as we paused at one of the three-dimensional exhibits, I asked Dad the question I always asked. What's it like? Out in space. Mother shot me a frightened glance. It was too late. Dad stood there for a full half minute trying to find an answer. Then he shrugged. It's the best thing in a lifetime of best things. Then he caught himself. Oh, it's really nothing at all. Routine. You wouldn't like it. He looked at me apprehensively. But you always go back. Habit. Where are you going next? I haven't decided yet. I'll think it over. He always thought it over. In those days, rocket pilots were rare, and he could pick and choose, work when he liked. On the third night of his homecoming, you could see him picking and choosing among the stars. Come on, said Mother. Let's go home. It was still early when we got home. I wanted Dad to put on his uniform. I shouldn't have asked. It always made Mother unhappy. But I could not help myself. I kept at him, though he had always refused. I had never seen him in it. And at last he said, Oh, all right. We waited in the parlor while he went upstairs and the air flew. Mother looked at me dully, as if she couldn't believe that her own son could do this to her. I glanced away. I'm sorry, I said. You're not helping at all, she said. At all. There was a whisper in the air flue a moment later. Here I am, said Dad quietly. We looked at him in his uniform. It was glossy black with silver buttons and silver rims to the heels of the black boots, and it looked as if someone had cut the arms and legs and body from a dark nebula with little faint stars glowing through it. It fit as close as a glove fits to a slender long hand, and it smelled like cool air and metal and space. It smelled of fire and time. Father stood, smiling awkwardly, in the center of the room. Turn around, said Mother. Her eyes were remote, looking at him. When he was gone, she never talked of him. She never said anything about anything but the weather or the condition of my neck and the need of a washcloth for it, or the fact that she didn't sleep nights. Once she said the light was too strong at night. But there's no moon this week, I said. There's starlight, she said. I went to the store and bought her some darker, greener shades. As I lay in bed at night, I could hear her pull them down tight to the bottom of the windows. It made a long, rustling noise. Once I tried to mow the lawn. No! Mom stood in the door. Put the mower away! So the grass went 3 months at a time without cutting. Dad cut it when he came home. She wouldn't let me do anything else either, like repairing the electrical breakfast maker or the mechanical book reader. She saved everything up, as if for Christmas. And then I would see Dad hammering or tinkering and always smiling at his work, and Mother smiling over him, happy. No, she never talked of him when he was gone. And as for Dad, he never did anything to make contact across the millions of miles. He said once, "If I called you, I'd want to be with you. I wouldn't be happy." Once Dad said to me, "Your mother treats me, sometimes, as if I weren't here. As if I were invisible." I had seen her do it. She would look just beyond him, over his shoulder, at his chin or hands, but never into his eyes. If she did look at his eyes, her eyes were covered with a film, like an animal going to sleep. She said yes at the right times and smiled, but always a half a second later than expected. "I'm not there for her," said Dad. But other days she would be there, and he would be there for her, and they would hold hands and walk around the block or take rides, with Mom's hair flying like a girl's behind her, and she would cut off all the mechanical devices in the kitchen and bake him incredible cakes and pies and cookies, looking deep into his face, her smile a real smile. But at the end of such days, when he was there to her, she would always cry. And Dad would stand helpless, gazing about the room as if to find the answer, but never finding it. Dad turned slowly, in his uniform, for us to see. "Turn around again," said Mom. The next morning, Dad came rushing into the house with handfuls of tickets. Pink rocket tickets for California, blue tickets for Mexico. "Come on," he said. "We'll buy disposable clothes and burn them when they're soiled. Look, we take the noon rocket to L.A., the 2 o'clock helicopter to Santa Barbara, the 9 o'clock plane to Ensenada. Sleep overnight." And we went to California and up and down the Pacific coast for a day and a half, settling at last on the sands of Malibu to cook wieners at night. Dad was always listening or singing or watching things on all sides of him, holding on to things as if the world were a centrifuge, going so swiftly that he might be flung off away from us at any instant. The last afternoon at Malibu, Mom was up in the hotel room. Dad lay on the sand beside me for a long time in the hot sun. "Ah," he sighed, "this is it." His eyes were gently closed. He lay on his back, drinking the sun. "You miss this," he said. He meant on the rocket, of course. But he never said the rocket, or mentioned the rocket, and all the things you couldn't have on the rocket. You couldn't have a salt wind on the rocket, or a blue sky, or a yellow sun, or Mom's cooking. You couldn't talk to your 14-year-old boy on a rocket. "Let's hear it," he said at last. And I knew now that we would talk, as we had always talked, for 3 hours straight. All afternoon we would murmur back and forth in the lazy sun about my school grades, how high I could jump, how fast I could swim. Dad nodded each time I spoke and smiled and slapped my chest lightly in approval. We talked. We did not talk of rockets or space, but we talked of Mexico, where we had driven once in an ancient car, and of the butterflies we had caught in the rainforests of green, warm Mexico at noon, seeing the 100 butterflies sucked to our radiator, dying there, beating their blue and crimson wings, twitching, beautiful, and sad. We talked of such things instead of the things I wanted to talk about. And he listened to me. That was the thing he did, as if he was trying to fill himself up with all the sound he could hear. He listened to the wind and the falling ocean and my voice, always with a rapt attention, a concentration that almost excluded physical bodies themselves and kept only the sounds. He shut his eyes to listen. I would see him listening to the lawnmower as he cut the grass by hand instead of using the remote control device, and I would see him smelling the cut grass as it sprayed up at him behind the mower in a green fount. "Doug," he said, About 5 in the afternoon, as we were picking up our towels and heading back along the beach near the surf. "I want you to promise me something."
"What?"
"Don't ever be a rocket man."
I stopped.
"I mean it," he said. "Because when you're out there, you want to be here, and when you're here, you want to be out there. Don't start that. Don't let it get hold of you."
"But..."
"You don't know what it is. Every time I'm out there, I think, if I ever get back to Earth, I'll stay there. I'll never go out again. But I go out, and I guess I'll always go out."
"I've thought about being a rocket man for a long time," I said. He didn't hear me.
"I try to stay here. Last Saturday, when I got home, I started trying so damned hard to stay here. I remembered him in the garden, sweating, and all the traveling and doing and listening, and I knew that he did this to convince himself that the sea and the towns and the land and his family were the only real things and the good things. But I knew where he would be tonight, looking at the jewelry in Orion from our front porch." "Promise me you won't be like me," he said. I hesitated a while.
"Okay," I said.
He shook my hand.
"Good boy," he said.
The dinner was fine that night. Mom had run about the kitchen with handfuls of cinnamon and dough and pots and pans tinkling, and now a great turkey fumed on the table with dressing, cranberry sauce, peas, and pumpkin pie. "In the middle of August?" said Dad, amazed.
"You won't be here for Thanksgiving."
"So I won't." He sniffed it. He lifted each lid from each tureen and let the flavor steam over his sunburned face. He said, "Ah," to each. He looked at the room and his hands. He gazed at the pictures on the wall, the chairs, the table, me and Mom. He cleared his throat. I saw him make up his mind.
"Lily?"
"Yes?"
Mom looked across her table, which she had set like a wonderful silver trap, a miraculous gravy pit into which, like a struggling beast of the past caught in a tar pool, her husband might at last be caught and held, gazing out through a jail of wishbones, safe forever. Her eyes sparkled.
"Lily," said Dad.
"Go on," I thought crazily. "Say it quick. Say you'll stay home this time for good and never go away. Say it." Just then a passing helicopter jarred the room and the window pane shook with a crystal sound. Dad glanced at the window. The blue stars of evening were there, and the red planet Mars was rising in the east. Dad looked at Mars a full minute. Then he put his hand out blindly toward me.
"May I have some peas?" he said.
"Excuse me," said Mother. "I'm going to get some bread."
She rushed out into the kitchen.
"But there's bread on the table," I said.
Dad didn't look at me as he began his meal. I couldn't sleep that night. I came downstairs at 1 in the morning, and the moonlight was like ice on all the housetops, and dew glittered in a snowfield on our grass. I stood in the doorway in my pajamas, feeling the warm night wind, and then I knew that Dad was sitting in the mechanical porch swing, gliding gently. I could see his profile, tilted back, and he was watching the stars wheel over the sky. His eyes were like gray crystal there, the moon in each one. I went out and sat beside him. We glided a while in the swing. At last I said,
"How many ways are there to die in space?"
A million.
Name some.
The meteors hit you. The air goes out of your rocket. Or comets take you along with them. Concussion. Strangulation. Explosion. Centrifugal force. Too much acceleration. Too little. The heat, the cold, the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets, the asteroids, the planetoids. Radiation.
And do they bury you?
They never find you.
Where do you go?
A billion miles away. Traveling graves, they call them. You become a meteor or a planetoid traveling forever through space. I said nothing. One thing, he said later. It's quick in space. Death. It's over like that. You don't linger. Most of the time you don't even know it. You're dead and that's it. We went up to bed. It was morning. Standing in the doorway, Dad listened to the yellow canary singing in its golden cage. Well, I've decided, he said. Next time I come home, I'm home to stay.
Dad, I said.
Tell your mother that when she gets up, he said.
You mean it?
He nodded gravely. See you in about 3 months. And there he went off down the street, carrying his uniform in its secret box, whistling and looking at the tall green trees and picking china berries off the china berry bush as he brushed by, tossing them ahead of him as he walked away into the bright shade of early morning. I asked Mother about a few things that morning after Father had been gone a number of hours.
Dad said that sometimes you don't act as if you hear or see him, I said. And then she explained everything to me quietly. When he went off into space 10 years ago, I said to myself, he's dead, or as good as dead. So think of him dead. And when he comes back 3 or 4 times a year, it's not him at all. It's only a pleasant little memory or a dream. And if a memory stops or a dream stops, it can't hurt half as much. So most of the time I think of him dead. But other times I can't help myself. I bake pies and treat him as if he were alive, and then it hurts. Now it's better to think he hasn't been here for 10 years, and I'll never see him again. It doesn't hurt as much.
Didn't he say next time he'd settle down? She shook her head slowly.
No. He's dead. I'm very sure of that. He'll come alive again then, I said. 10 years ago, said Mother, I thought, what if he dies on Venus? Then we'll never be able to see Venus again. What if he dies on Mars? We'll never be able to look at Mars again, all red in the sky, without wanting to go in and lock the door. Or what if he died on Jupiter or Saturn or Neptune? On those nights when those planets were high in the sky, we wouldn't want to have anything to do with the stars. I guess not, I said. The message came the next day.
The messenger gave it to me, and I read it standing on the porch. The sun was setting. Mom stood in the screen door behind me, watching me fold the message and put it in my pocket.
Mom,
I said.
Don't tell me anything I don't already know,
she said. She didn't cry. Well, it wasn't Mars, and it wasn't Venus, and it wasn't Jupiter or Saturn that killed him. We wouldn't have to think of him every time Jupiter or Saturn or Mars lit up the evening sky. This was different. His ship had fallen into the sun. And the sun was big and fiery and merciless, and it was always in the sky, and you couldn't get away from it. So for a long time after my father died, my mother slept through the days and wouldn't go out. We had breakfast at midnight, and lunch at 3 in the morning, and dinner at the cold, dim hour of 6 a.m. We went to all-night shows and went to bed at sunrise. And for a long while, the only days we ever went out to walk were the days when it was raining. And there was no sun. 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 The last night of the world. What would you do if you knew that this was the last night of the world?
What would I do? You mean seriously?
Yes, seriously.
I don't know. I hadn't thought.
He poured some coffee. In the background, the two girls were playing blocks on the parlor rug in the light of the green hurricane lamps. There was an easy, clean aroma of the brewed coffee in the evening air. Well, better start thinking about it, he said.
You don't mean it.
He nodded.
A war?
He shook his head.
Not the hydrogen or atom bomb.
No.
Or germ warfare?
None of those at all, he said, stirring his coffee slowly. But just, let's say, the closing of a book.
I don't think I understand.
No. Nor do I, really. It's just a feeling. Sometimes it frightens me. Sometimes I'm not frightened at all, but at peace. He glanced in at the girls and their yellow hair shining in the lamplight. I didn't say anything to you. It first happened about 4 nights ago.
What?
A dream I had. I dreamed that it was all going to be over, and a voice said it was. Not any kind of voice I can remember, but a voice anyway. And it said things would stop here on Earth. I didn't think too much about it the next day, but then I went to the office and caught Stan Willis looking out the window in the middle of the afternoon. And I said, "A penny for your thoughts, Stan." And he said, "I had a dream last night," and before he even told me the dream, I knew what it was. I could have told him, but he told me, and I listened to him.
It was the same dream?
The same. I told Stan I had dreamed it, too. He didn't seem surprised. He relaxed, in fact. Then we started walking through the office for the hell of it. It wasn't planned. We didn't say, "Let's walk around." We just walked around on our own, and everywhere we saw people looking at their desks or their hands or out windows. I talked to a few. So did Stan.
And they all had dreamed.
All of them. Same dream, with no difference.
Do you believe in it?
Yes. I've never been more certain.
And when will it stop? The world, I mean.
Sometime during the night for us. And then as the night goes on around the world, that'll go too. It'll take 24 hours for it all to go.
They sat a while, not touching their coffee. Then they lifted it slowly and drank, looking at each other. Do we deserve this?
She said. It's not a matter of deserving. It's just that things didn't work out. I noticed you didn't even argue about this.
Why not?
I guess I have a reason, she said. The same one everyone at the office had.
She nodded slowly. I didn't want to say anything. It happened last night. And the women on the block talked about it among themselves today. They dreamed. I thought it was only a coincidence. She picked up the evening paper. There's nothing in the paper about it.
Everyone knows, so there's no need.
He sat back in his chair, watching her.
Are you afraid?
No. I always thought I would be. But I'm not.
Where's that spirit called self-preservation they talk so much about?
I don't know. You don't get too excited when you feel things are logical. This is logical. Nothing else but this could have happened from the way we've lived.
We haven't been too bad, have we?
No, nor enormously good. I suppose that's the trouble. We haven't been very much of anything except us, while a big part of the world was busy being lots of quite awful things. The girls were laughing in the parlor.
I always thought people would be screaming in the streets at a time like this.
I guess not. You don't scream about the real thing.
Do you know, I won't miss anything but you and the girls. I never liked cities or my work or anything except you three. I won't miss a thing except perhaps the change in the weather. And a glass of ice water when it's hot. And I might miss sleeping. How can we sit here and talk this way?
Because there's nothing else to do.
That's it, of course. For if there were, we'd be doing it. I suppose this is the first time in the history of the world that everyone has known just what they were going to do during the night.
I wonder what everyone else will do now, this evening, for the next few hours.
Go to a show, listen to the radio, watch television, play cards, put the children to bed, go to bed themselves, like always.
In a way, that's something to be proud of, like always.
They sat a moment, and then he poured himself another coffee. Why do you suppose it's tonight?
Because?
Why not some other night in the last century, or 5 centuries ago, or 10?
Maybe it's because it was never October 19, 1969, ever before in history, and now it is, and that's it. Because it's the year when things are as they are all over the world, and that's why it's the end.
There are bombers on their schedules, both ways across the ocean tonight, that'll never see land.
That's part of the reason why.
Well, he said, getting up. What shall it be? Wash the dishes?
They washed the dishes and stacked them away with special neatness. At 8:30, the girls were put to bed and kissed goodnight. And the little lights by their beds turned on, and the door left open just a trifle.
I wonder, said the husband, coming from the bedroom and glancing back, standing there with the pipe for a moment.
What?
If the door will be shut all the way. Or if it'll be left just a little ajar so some light comes in.
I wonder if the children know.
No, of course not. They sat and read the papers and talked and listened to some radio music, and then sat together by the fireplace, watching the charcoal embers as the clock struck 10:30, and 11, and 11:30. They thought of all the other people in the world who had spent their evening, each in his own special way. "Well," he said at last. He kissed his wife for a long time.
"We've been good for each other anyway."
"Do you want to cry?" he asked.
"I don't think so."
They moved through the house and turned out the lights and went into the bedroom and stood in the night-cool darkness, undressing and pushing back the covers.
"The sheets are so clean and nice."
"I'm tired."
"We're all tired."
They got into bed and lay back.
"Just a moment," she said.
He heard her get out of bed and go into the kitchen. A moment later she returned.
"I left the water running in the sink," she said.
Something about this was so very funny that he had to laugh. She laughed with him, knowing what it was that she had done that was funny. They stopped laughing at last and lay in their cool night bed, their hands clasped, their heads together. "Good night," he said after a moment.
"Good night,"
she said. The Exiles. Their eyes were fire, and the breath flamed out the witches' mouths as they bent to probe the cauldron with greasy stick and bony finger.
"When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?"
They danced drunkenly on the shore of an empty sea, fouling the air with their three tongues and burning it with their cat's eyes malevolently aglitter.
"Round about the cauldron go, in the poison entrails throw. Double, double, toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble!"
They paused and cast a glance about.
"Where's the crystal? Where's the needles? Here! Good! Is the yellow wax thickened? Yes! Pour it in the iron mould! Is the wax figure done?"
They shaped it like molasses adrip on their green hands.
"Shove the needle through the heart! The crystal! The crystal! Fetch it from the taro bag! Dust it off! Have a look!"
They bent to the crystal, their faces white.
"See, see, see!"
A rocket ship moved through space from the planet Earth to the planet Mars. On the rocket ship, men were dying. The captain raised his head tiredly.
"We'll have to use the morphine."
"But, Captain, you see yourself this man's condition!"
The captain lifted the wool blanket, and the man, restrained beneath the wet sheet, moved and groaned. The air was full of sulphurous thunder.
"I saw it! I saw it!"
The man opened his eyes and stared at the port, where there were only black spaces, reeling stars, Earth far removed, and the planet Mars rising large and red.
"I saw it! A bat! A huge thing! A bat with a man's face spread over the front port. Fluttering and fluttering, fluttering and fluttering."
"Pulse?"
asked the captain. The orderly measured it.
130.
"He can't go on with that. Use the morphine. Come along, Smith."
They moved away,
Suddenly the floor plates were laced with bone and white skulls that screamed. The captain did not dare look down, and over the screaming he said, "Is this where Perse is?" turning in at a hatch. A white-smocked surgeon stepped away from a body.
"I just don't understand it. How did Perse die?"
"We don't know, Captain. It wasn't his heart, his brain, or shock. He just died."
The captain felt the doctor's wrist, which changed to a hissing snake and bit him. The captain did not flinch.
"Take care of yourself. You've a pulse, too."
The doctor nodded.
"Perse complained of pains, needles," he said,
"in his wrists and legs. Said he felt like wax melting. He fell. I helped him up. He cried like a child, said he had a silver needle in his heart. He died. Here he is. We can repeat the autopsy for you. Everything's physically normal.
That's impossible. He died of something."
The captain walked to a port. He smelled of menthol and iodine and green soap on his polished and manicured hands. His white teeth were dentrified, and his ears scoured to a pinkness, as were his cheeks. His uniform was the color of new salt, and his boots were black mirrors shining below him. His crisp crew-cut hair smelled of sharp alcohol. Even his breath was sharp and new and clean. There was no spot to him. He was a fresh instrument, honed and ready, still hot from the surgeon's oven. The men with him were from the same mold. One expected huge brass keys spiraling slowly from their backs. They were expensive, talented, well-oiled toys, obedient and quick. The captain watched the planet Mars grow very large in space.
"We'll be landing in an hour on that damn place. Smith, did you see any bats or have other nightmares?"
"Yes, sir. The month before our rocket took off from New York, sir. White rats biting my neck, drinking my blood. I didn't tell. I was afraid you wouldn't let me come on this trip."
"Never mind," sighed the captain. "I had dreams, too. In all of my 50 years, I never had a dream until that week before we took off from Earth. And then every night I dreamed I was a white wolf, caught on a snowy hill, shot with a silver bullet, buried with a stake in my heart."
He moved his head toward Mars.
"Do you think, Smith, they know we're coming?"
"We don't know if there are Martian people, sir,
don't we?"
"They began frightening us off 8 weeks ago, before we started.
They've killed Perse and Reynolds now. Yesterday they made Grenville go blind. How? I don't know. Bats, needles, dreams, men dying for no reason. I'd call it witchcraft in another day. But this is the year 2120, Smith. We're rational men. This all can't be happening. But it is. Whoever they are, with their needles and their bats, they'll try to finish us all."
He swung about. "Smith, fetch those books from my file. I want them when we land." 200 books were piled on the rocket desk.
"Thank you, Smith. Have you glanced at them? Think I'm insane? Perhaps. It's a crazy hunch. At that last moment, I ordered these books from the Historical Museum, because of my dreams. 20 nights I was stabbed, butchered, a screaming bat pinned to a surgical mat, a thing rotting underground in a black box. Bad, wicked dreams. Our whole crew dreamed of witch things and were-things, vampires and phantoms, things they couldn't know anything about. Why? Because books on such ghastly subjects were destroyed a century ago. By law. Forbidden for anyone to own the grisly volumes. These books you see here are the last copies, kept for historical purposes in the locked museum vaults."
Smith bent to read the dusty titles.
"Tales of Mystery and Imagination by Edgar Allan Poe. Dracula by Bram Stoker.
Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, The Turn of the Screw by Henry James, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving, Rappaccini's Daughter by Nathaniel Hawthorne, An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge by Ambrose Bierce, Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll, The Willows by Algernon Blackwood, The Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum, The Weird Shadow over Innsmouth by H.P. Lovecraft, and more. Books by Walter de la Mare, Wakefield, Harvey, Wells, Asquith, Huxley, all forbidden authors. All burned in the same year that Halloween was outlawed and Christmas was banned. But, sir, what good are these to us on the rocket?
I don't know, sighed the captain. Yet.
The three hags lifted the crystal where the captain's image flickered, his tiny voice tinkling out of the glass.
I don't know, sighed the captain. Yet.
The three witches glared redly into one another's faces.
We haven't much time, said one.
Better warn them in the city. They'll want to know about the books. It doesn't look good. That fool of a captain. In an hour they'll land their rocket.
The three hags shuddered and blinked up at the Emerald City by the edge of the dry Martian sea. In its highest window a small man held a blood-red drape aside. He watched the wastelands where the three witches fed their cauldron and shaped the waxes. Farther along 10,000 other blue fires and laurel incenses, black tobacco smokes and fir weeds, cinnamons and bone dusts, rose soft as moths through the Martian night. The man counted the angry, magical fires. Then, as the three witches stared, he turned. The crimson drape released, fell, causing the distant portal to wink like a yellow eye. Mr. Edgar Allan Poe stood in the tower window, a faint vapor of spirits upon his breath.
Hecate's friends are busy tonight, he said, seeing the witches far below.
A voice behind him said,
I saw Will Shakespeare at the shore earlier, whipping them on.
All along the sea, Shakespeare's army alone, tonight, numbers thousands. The three witches, Oberon, Hamlet's father, Puck, all of them, thousands. Good Lord, a regular sea of people.
Good, William.
Poe turned. He let the crimson drape fall shut. He stood for a moment to observe the raw stone room, the black-timbered table, the candle flame.